Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matter. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Irrational behavior is a part of human nature. But as MIT professor Dan Ariely has discovered after 20 years of research, people tend to behave irrationally in a predictable fashion. In his new book, Predictably Irrational, Ariely argues that greater understanding of forces such as emotions, relativity, and social norms can bring startling insights into the realms of individual motivation and consumer choice. The findings have significant implications at all levels of business, from executive planning to the everyday behaviors of individuals in the workplace. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First, let's talk a little bit about the background of Predictably Irrational. The framework for the book is the emerging field of behavioral economics. What exactly is behavioral economics, and how does it differ from traditional economics?
The basic idea is that economics assumes that people are rational and everything that comes from it. Behavioral economics is interested in the same questions about shopping and buying and falling in love and making investment in the stock market and so on, but without assuming people are rational. And instead, it's using experimental method to find out what people are really doing and has very different predictions about what we should be doing in society as a consequence of that.
People act irrationally. They always have. But where your research stands out is that it shows while people may act irrationally, they don't act randomly. Their irrational behavior follows predictable patterns, which you identify in the book. So if irrationality plays such a fundamental role in how we make decisions, do you think that tells us something about intuition? Should people really trust their gut feelings?
No. There's some things that our intuitions are correct about, but it's interesting that most of the stuff that I work on, people's intuitions are actually wrong. These are not things that are included in our intuitions. In fact, my whole journey into behavioral economics started because of wrong intuitions. When I was in the burn department many years ago, I was injured in a severe accident, and about 70% of my body was burned. And the nurses had the intuition that the right thing to do for me, the right way to take bandages off me every day, was to rip them off as quickly as possible and get the treatment in less than an hour. When I got out of the hospital, I started doing experiments. Try to see what would be the right way to take bandages of burned patients. Is it better to do it slower, over a longer duration of time, but lower intensity? Would it be the way that they said it, which is quick but very, very painful every moment? Would it be good to have it from the least painful to the most painful, or the other way around? And what I found out was the nurses' intuitions were wrong. I found that while they were good and kind individuals who had a lot of experience and good intentions, nevertheless, they didn't get it right. And in fact, all of my research has been showing over the years, intuitions are not enough to protect us. When we get things wrong repeatedly, despite the fact that we try, and despite the fact that we have a lot of experience.
This is interesting. Some of the things you're mentioning here and in the book really run counter to a lot of very popular business books that are out right now. You should trust your intuition. It doesn't lie. That type of thing. Let me continue here. Management gurus often talk about how instilling a sense of ownership in your employees can improve their performance. It turns out, according to your book, that there's some hard evidence that ownership is, in fact, a powerful psychological motivator. Can you explain the ownership effect?
I'll give you a crazy example. Don't take it too seriously. But imagine I asked you, how much would you sell your kids for? Now, of course, we're not selling our kids, but imagine it was acceptable.
Well, it's a podcast, and I'm open to any offers that might come in.
Most people say, you know, my kid is really special. I wouldn't give him up for a lot of money. But imagine then I ask you, how much would you buy your specific kid with his specific attribute if it wasn't yours? Most people say, no, I really don't see that particular kid as being that valuable. Now, market for kids, of course, is a terrible thing, but the idea is that the value for kids to us is not because of the particular attributes of the kid, it's because they're ours. Now, it turns out that this is not limited to kids. It's about everything. The moment I give you a watch and you start thinking about it as yours, you've switched your perspective. You become hooked. It's now part of yours. It's a little bit like your kid, and you start valuing it more. And interestingly enough, even when we bid on things on eBay, the moment we're the highest bidder, we start thinking ourselves as the winner, as the owner of that particular item, even though the auction is not over yet. And as a consequence, we start liking it a bit more and start to feel a little bit worse when somebody else overbids us.
So actually, there might be a strategy where you could utilize the ownership effect and make somebody an owner of something or whatever and leverage that feeling.
That's right. I think the 30-day money-back guarantee works very much this way. There are some things that if you would take home and you would put them in your house for 30 days and you would get used to thinking of yourself as owning them, and you would have a much harder time giving them up later on.
Okay, now when it comes to managing and leading people, what are some of the other lessons you think can be learned from your research?
One of the things about management is the idea that we live in two worlds. We live in a social world in which we do favors to people, and we live in a financial world in which we work for money. And the thing is that the modern workplace is kind of a mixture between those two. So first, let's examine the two. Imagine that I ask you to help me change a tire on my car. There's a good chance you'll say, sure, I'll help you. How about if I offered you $5? The chances are now that you will not say, gee, I get to help done plus I get $5. Instead, the $5 would chase away the social motivation, and you would say, I don't work for $5. Give me $150, we can talk again. Now, if you think about it, when I offer you no money, you're doing it for social reasons. When I offer you money, you're saying, now it's a job and we need to talk about it. Now, the modern workplace is somewhere in the middle. We work for pay, of course, but many of us work on a monthly salary, when it's not exactly clear what workplace is paying us for and what it's not, when is the work hour starting and ending. And this is why we're so happy to work at night and on the weekends and take our BlackBerries home with us and do all kinds of things. I think that businesses don't understand it because they are actually, in today's economy, trying to hurt that social relationship. And perhaps the worst example, or the best example for the principal, but the worst for businesses, is the issue with health benefits. Businesses are now telling employees, look, I'll pay you an extra $15,000 a year if I don't have to cover your health-wise. Now, individuals might opt for it. They might say, okay, this is a good deal. I can buy health insurance for less money. But at the same time, businesses are losing some of the motivation. They're losing some of the social exchange. And as a consequence, they might actually get less dedication.
Because the workers don't feel as valued.
That's right. And let me give an example for this. Imagine you invite me to come to your house for dinner, and I'm going to spend $40 buying you a bottle of wine. Now, it's a very inefficient gift. I don't know if wine is the best thing to get for you, and even if it was, I'm not sure what wine would be the ideal wine to get you. So what I should be doing from an economics perspective is to say, thank you very much for the invitation. Here's $40. Please buy yourself the best thing you can. And financially, this is best. Financially, it's the same as giving people money in terms of healthcare. But has it in any way increased our friendship? I don't think so. So gift, while being financially inefficient, it's actually very socially efficient because it would actually create a bond between you and me, and that's why the dinner is there to start with.
Your research has also turned up some interesting insights into procrastination and into possible ways to overcome it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. As a professor, of course, I see procrastination all the time. At the beginning of the semesters, my students have clean notebooks and eager looks in their eyes, and they always vow to keep ahead of the reading, and toward the end of the semester, there are strange illnesses and dead relatives and all kinds of excuses coming up. Now, a couple of years, I offered my students a deal. I said, look, you owe me 3 papers this term, but here is what I'm offering you. You can commit today to when you want to submit each of these papers. And now, the day that you commit are binding. You can always be early, but you can't be late. And if you're late by even 1 day, you lose a point grade for each day you're late. So it's very costly. Now, if students are rational, what should they do? They should say the semester ends on May 2nd. I'll submit everything on May 2nd. Why would I possibly commit to an earlier deadline when I don't have to? But what if the students know they procrastinate? What if they know that if they owe 3 papers on May 2nd, they will start working May 1st, and they will produce bad quality work and plus not sleep the whole night? Would they, under this situation, space out the deadlines, and would it actually help them achieve better results? The interesting thing that it does, the students space the deadlines and they actually got to do better. Now, this, I think, is a big promise of behavioral economics. It's saying, look, if we create a tool where people can bind their behavior, they can actually improve their performance. Now, it's interesting that no student ever came to me and said, Professor Ariely, would you please give us an earlier deadline? They didn't come with it by themselves, but the moment I gave them the tool, they actually did better. We're testing this now with healthcare. So imagine that I schedule for you a colonoscopy for May 28. What's the chance that you will wake up May 28 in the morning and feel that today is a good day for colonoscopy? Not very high. So most likely you'll wake up in that day and try to find some excuse of why you shouldn't go today. How about if today, when I schedule this for you, I say, look, give me a check for for $250. And if you don't show up on May 28th for your colonoscopy on time, I'll deposit that check. If you understand that this check would help you wake up on May 28th and actually go for the exam, you might actually be willing to risk that money just to force yourself to behave better in the future. When we're testing this thing right now in only hypothetical situations, people are quite understanding this mechanism and many of them are willing to adapt it.
One other quick question here. Just what is the response from the business community to the findings in your book? What are you hearing from them?
There are kind of two responses. There are basically two types of businesses. There are types of businesses that think that their incentive, that the business incentives and the consumer incentives are misaligned, that the business will do better when the consumer does worse. So, for example, if you think about it, how can a supermarket convince individuals to buy more food? Or how can a health club get people to pay more for participation but not necessarily come more often? And these are cases where people are trying to find traps that people would fall into in terms of the decision-making. Then there's the second category in which the incentive of the businesses and consumer are the same. These are cases like the saving industry. People are basically dramatically under-saving, and for everybody it would be good if people saved more. Or the healthcare industry, where people are dramatically not taking enough care of their health, and everybody's incentive is to increase the amount that people take care of their health. Those, I think, are actually the bigger problem in society and where the big promise for behavioral economics actually comes out.
Dan, I want to wrap this up with just, is there anything you want to share with us related to this book that you feel, just in general, people aren't aware of or should be made aware of?
One interesting thing that I find is that when we come to build products in the world, bicycles, chairs, computers, whatever, we take into account human limitations. We see what we can do and what we can't do, and we basically build products for real people. When it comes to build products for the mind, for things that don't have these physical limitations, insurance products, healthcare products, annuities, savings, and so on, for some reason we assume that people are perfectly rational. We assume that we're building products for Superman. And I think that to the extent that we can examine our limitations in the mental domain, in the cognitive domain, in the same way that we think of it in the physical domain, we might actually be able to create a better product and a better world.
We'd like to thank our guest today, Dan Ariely. He's the author of a new book, Predictably Irrational. Dan, thank you for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
Hi, this is Terry Seaman. I'm one of the portfolio managers here at AMA. And joining me is Joanne Malone, one of our faculty members. Hi, Joanne.
Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm doing real well. This podcast with Dan Ariely is very interesting, don't you think?
Yes, I do.
What would you suggest that practicing managers think about in terms of what Dan and your research is finding out about decision-making?
I would say that Dan is accurate in his depiction that there are some traps in decision-making, that if, in fact, we rely too much on our intuition or a gut feeling, it, in fact, can lead us to choosing the wrong alternative and then lead us into some decision regret. What I would recommend, and in fact we are putting together in our high-impact decision-making course for the American Management Association, is a more balanced approach. That clearly there are several components to a decision. There's data and information that's available to you, so that's the more rational side, if you will. Then oftentimes we do have some sort of feeling about it, some emotion associated with it, and that emotion could be very personal to us, or it could be a fear. I'm afraid of the unknown. I'm not sure. I'm not comfortable with making the risk. And then finally, we should be looking at it from a more strategic approach or what might happen in the future. And again, the dilemma with that is we don't have a lot of data to support that, and it's unknown to us.
So this is an upcoming AMA course. What's it called again?
High Impact Decision Making, Reducing Risk, Maximizing Results.
What would you say would be the key takeaways that a manager will get from that?
First of all, when we're talking about high-impact decision-making in business, we're not talking about where we're going to go have lunch today. We're talking about those things that will impact the financials, the people, the processes, or the reputation of your business. And these really are decisions that require us not to make snap judgments, not to simply rely on the data that's in front of us, but really take the time to think clearly about the decision. So in the high-impact decision-making course, we're really encouraging people to stop and take the time to reflect appropriately on their emotional state, the rational data that's available to them, and then think through to the what-ifs or the unknowns into the future.
Joanne, it's a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Terry. I've enjoyed it as well.
That course, again, is High Impact Decision Making, Reducing Risks, Maximizing Results, course number 2564, and anyone interested can register at amanet.org.
It would be great to hear your feedback on this program, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.